Hello, Douglas Hardy here on Tuesday the 2nd of June. Coming up in today's show, Alistair Darling's future in the balance. Will he be reshuffled following his expenses mistake?
I think that making Ed Balls Chancellor would be a huge step for the Prime Minister.
After being declared bankrupt, work begins on trying to rebuild General Motors.
Because GM is such a huge world company, it's led to governments all around the world having to get involved.
And as Susan Boyle receives treatment at the Priory, we ask whether reality TV producers should feel responsible. Before all that, though, let's get the latest news and take a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
Military planes and naval ships are searching a vast area of the Atlantic Ocean for remains of the Air France plane that disappeared yesterday. The Airbus 330 with 228 passengers on board was flying through thunderstorms on its flight from Brazil to France. Its last contact was by an automated message saying it was suffering electrical faults. Pilots arriving in Brazil are reporting they saw what looked like a fire on the surface of the ocean in the area where the plane disappeared. North Korea is reported to be preparing another missile test. This is according to American officials. The country was condemned yesterday by a conference of all its neighbours for its nuclear test last week. The heightened aggression by the country has been blamed on a succession struggle among the sons of the ageing leader. Now, intelligence sources report that Kim Jong-il's youngest son has been chosen to take over from him. Here in Britain, police have arrested a businessman wanted in connection with the death of his millionaire's girlfriend in a Paris hotel. Ian Griffin's now being questioned by police after being found living rough in woodlands near Macclesfield in the Greater Manchester area. He'd been staying with his girlfriend Kinga Legg in the Hotel Le Bristol. When he left suddenly, she was found dead in a bathroom with her body battered and bruised. Children as young as seven are being used by teenagers to carry knives for them. The House of Commons Home Affairs Committee says knives are now so widespread among youths, it's almost an arms race. They use the younger children to carry their weapons to avoid being caught. The MPs want a further crackdown by police. The former Milan boss, Carlo Ancelotti, has been confirmed as the new manager of Chelsea just days after the team won the FA Cup under their caretaker, Gus Hiddink. Ancelotti has signed a three-year contract worth over £6 million a year with a £1 million bonus if he wins a European Cup. That story takes over this morning's sports pages. As the Times put it, "I must win the Champions League in 3 years." Several papers speculate on players being bought by Chelsea from the big clubs in Italy. But The Sun and The Mail both agree on what the headline really is, the £1 million bonus for European success. Then he'll win the lottery, they say. On the front pages, most lead with either more on MPs' expenses or the French plane crash. Five Britons are believed to be among the passengers. There's a common photo of a worried woman going into Paris-Charles de Gaulle Airport. The Guardian's headline is "Thunderstorms, an automatic message, then AF447 vanished." All the papers reckon the likely cause of the disaster was the electrical storms. The Guardian also reports, along with the Telegraph and the Financial Times, that beleaguered Darling faces reshuffle axe. The Telegraph says the Chancellor faces the sack after being forced to pay back cash, over £600 that he says he mistakenly claimed in expenses. In interviews yesterday, though the Prime Minister said he'd done a good job, the FT says Brown refuses to rule out his replacement after the Thursday Euro election vote. The paper leading the expenses story for 26 days, The Telegraph, claims this morning the Transport Secretary Geoff Hoon is also in trouble after he claimed on two homes at the same time. And he's also had to pay money back. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Alistair Darling's future remains unclear after Gordon Brown said that the Chancellor had made a mistake in his expenses claims. Earlier, Brown had defended Darling, saying there was no foundation to allegations that he'd done wrong. The Prime Minister has also dodged questions about whether the Chancellor will remain in his post after a cabinet reshuffle, which may come as early as this Friday. I've been speaking with our political correspondent, Nicholas Watt.
Well, I think that Alistair Darling has not had a glorious 48 hours with his expenses. Yesterday's Daily Telegraph had reports that he had flipped his homes and that he'd declared for a service charge on his London property after he'd moved into number 11 as Chancellor way back in 2007. He initially said that he hadn't done anything wrong, and then by sort of yesterday lunchtime he was saying, oh, I did make a slip up. I quite innocently put through the expenses on my service charge, and actually it applied for 4 months in a 6 month period when I was living in number 11, so I will pay back £700. Now, this is not a hanging offence. This is not the Chancellor continuing to claim for mortgage interest on a property when he's no longer living there. That would have been a hanging offence. It seems to be an administrative slip up. But the problem for the Chancellor is that he is in charge of the nation's finances, and it appears that he doesn't have a particularly brilliant grasp of his own finances. And you had yesterday morning the Prime Minister saying on the radio and indeed on television, the Chancellor has done nothing wrong, there isn't a problem there, and then there a few hours later admitting that there is a minor problem. So difficult for a cabinet minister when the Prime Minister defends you and then it turns out that your story's not quite as it was, and difficult particularly for a Chancellor when your command of your own finances appears not to be completely brilliant.
So do you think this could tip the balance? I mean, there has been talk about Alistair Darling being moved in any case, in any potential reshuffle, and being replaced with Ed Balls. Do you think this might just tip it?
I think these expenses come at a difficult moment for Alistair Darling, because certainly the Prime Minister is looking at the idea of replacing the Chancellor. That doesn't mean he will be replaced, but he's looking at it. There are a number of arguments as to why you might want to do that. There's a feeling out there that the Chancellor did very well at the end of last year when he was involved in shoring up the economy, shoring up the banks, but that he is associated with that rather gloomy period. Also, I think there's a feeling that the Chancellor does not look wholly confident, and that he's not very good at taking the fight and the battle to the Tories. It was interesting last week during the parliamentary recess, there was a briefing by Ed Balls, the school secretary, lots of talk about him possibly being the next Chancellor. He gave a briefing about schools, but talked about so much else. The economy, of course, he was chief economist at the Treasury for 10 years. And he took the fight to the Tories in that briefing, and he took them apart and said, this is where they're weak. You don't get that with the Chancellor. He seems to be quite timid. He seems to be not completely confident. And I know that Gordon Brown believes that you need that sort of figure taking aggressively the case against the Tories out there. Now, that does not mean that Ed Balls will be made Chancellor. It doesn't necessarily mean that Alistair Darling will be moved as Chancellor. I think that making Ed Balls Chancellor would be a huge step for the Prime Minister. I think many ministers would say that is a step too far. That really is retreating to the bunker, because of course Ed Balls is the Prime Minister's closest ally. Ed Balls has many, many great qualities, as we saw last week at that briefing, as I mentioned, but he is a controversial figure. There are many in Cabinet who don't like him and who distrust him, and it would be a very big step, I think, in what is, as we know, because there has to be an election within a year's time, the last year of this government, to appoint your closest ally as Chancellor. I think that would be a step that would be too much for the Labour Party at the moment.
Nicholas Walt there, our correspondent from Westminster. Now, if the US government gets its way, General Motors is about to undergo a swift surgical process which will see it emerge smaller and more streamlined within 3 months. The car company is now officially bankrupt, the biggest industrial insolvency in US history. Yesterday evening, President Barack Obama spelled out the details of the GM rescue plan.
As this plan takes effect, GM will start building a larger share of its cars here at home, including fuel-efficient cars. In fact, if all goes according to plan, the share of GM cars sold in the United States that are made here will actually grow for the first time in 3 decades.
Our business editor, Dan Roberts, has been following this story since it emerged that General Motors was in trouble.
Well, I think it's easy to lose sight of how big a moment this is, really. I mean, it's been a long time coming. People were talking about GM filing for bankruptcy 7-8 years ago. It's been brought low by the credit crunch, which has obviously led to a big drop off in car sales. But I think it's also important because it marks a big stepping up of the US government's involvement in trying to restructure US industry. And because GM is such a huge world company, it's led to governments all around the world having to get involved in Germany, in this country, in Sweden. And therefore, this is quite a moment. I would say this is the sort of moment when the financial crisis sort of morphed into an economic crisis. This is the day when we really realize that some of our biggest companies outside banking are also swept up in this.
So is President Barack Obama using this in some way to kind of show that he's a sort of man of action?
I think whether he's using it or whether he's just being forced along by events, I don't know. But he's certainly striking out quite a different path to the way that George Bush handled this crisis. He's taken a big stake, a majority stake for the US taxpayer in General Motors. He's knocked some heads together and forced some of the bondholders to take a big haircut on the amount of money they have invested here. You know, some on the right have criticized him for actually favoring the unions too much and giving them too much of a sort of a weight in this. But I think that whichever side of the political debate one's on, he certainly galvanized things and knocked heads together in a way that wasn't happening before.
So GM now has protection from its creditors. In practical terms, you know, what happens now?
Well, in practical terms, remarkably little. I mean, one of the miracles of the US bankruptcy system is that Chapter 11, this process by which companies get protection from their creditors, allows the companies to carry on acting as normal. So cars will continue to be made and sold. But behind the scenes, it gives the management a stay of execution, which allows them to sort of hopefully restructure the business in a way that makes it more viable in the long term. Sadly, that's going to mean a lot of closures, a lot of factory closures, and a lot of layoffs. It means that some of the big creditors, whether they're bondholders or the unions acting on behalf of employees, they also have to restructure their assets. They have to accept, instead of debt in the company, they're going to be taking shares in the company, all of which makes them hopefully part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Practically, you might not notice it. If you were buying a GM car tomorrow, it would be exactly the same process as before. But symbolically, it's an important moment in sort of wiping the slate clean.
And you mentioned long-term viability. I mean, is GM going to survive in the long term, or is this the kind of beginning of the American car industry going the same way as the British one?
I'm an optimist about this. I think that the US car industry's got a lot of life in it yet. I also think, actually, paradoxically, the British car industry has been doing very well in recent years. It just hasn't been owned by British companies. We still make cars here in huge volumes, and I think the Americans will continue to make cars in huge volumes. But it does mean that they're going to have to sort of think about cars in a very different way. I mean, the US consumer was conditioned to be able to buy a new car every couple of years, debt financed, you know, the type of offers, the sort of 5-year 0% financing deals that we saw during the boom times, probably gone for good. Fewer cars will be sold. They'll have to be greener. You know, I think part of the strings attached from the Obama administration is going to be controls on emissions and fuel efficiency. But in the long run, will the US remain a huge market for cars? Of course it will. And I don't believe that they're all suddenly going to be made by Toyota.
Business editor Dan Roberts there. And now for a look back at the history of GM, I've been speaking with Jonathan Glancy about how this once mighty corporation fell from grace.
GM's glory days were really in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, the company dates back to 1908. It started off with Buick, the car company, and gradually acquired more and more of the early American car manufacturers. But I think when we think of its great days, they really were the days of the great roaring V8 engine, Fintels, Cadillacs and Chevrolets, the late 50s. These were designs by the great American car stylist who worked for General Motors called Harley Earl, or his successor Bill Mitchell. And they were dream cars, really, cars that caught a spirit of the age. Of course, they were huge gas guzzlers, but they were deeply glamorous, and they caught that spirit of the United States at its optimistic best in the post-war years.
And so, in your opinion, when did it all start to go wrong? Because obviously this hasn't happened overnight. So when did the first cracks really start to appear?
Well, the cracks started to appear because ultimately General Motors was building great gas-guzzling cars for, as it were, a previous generation. I mean, really, I suppose you could say the rot set in for companies like General Motors as long ago as the oil crisis of 1973-74. And you could say, in a way, without hindsight, that they didn't learn enough. I mean, they were making huge enormous, great, fat cars, really. Well, right up to now, they've been making them the whole time. And it was as if somehow the oil crisis would go away, that the environmental concerns would go away, that the Kyoto Conference didn't exist. It was almost as if, you know, the company was refusing to live in a new, leaner, cleaner world.
So they have essentially failed to adapt to environmental concerns and carried on building these gas guzzlers.
Well, they've carried on building sensationally big cars. I mean, most famous of all is the Hummer, which is a car that was developed from an American military vehicle. And the Hummer is a car today we tend to associate it with all the negative associations with, you know, drug dealers and drive-by shootings. And, well, now, whether that's true or not, actually, it is partly true. But the Hummer is a symbol, I suppose, of everything that was wrong. Cars that are so big that, in fact, they're illegal on certain roads. They're that heavy. A Hummer weighs 6,000 pounds, which is getting on for 3 tons. And it's not the sort of car you should really be pottering around on a school run or going shopping with or commuting with today.
Any other real clangers that you can highlight for us?
Well, the clangers, I mean, there's a whole range of cars called GM Saturn. What a GM Saturn? Very few British people know these cars. They were General Motors' small cars that actually emerged in the early 1990s, and each one of them looks like an ugly little cartoon blob that you might see on a television program. I mean, you should see a Teletubbies character driving one, but that's the sort of car they are. And they really, Americans somehow, I wonder what it is, American stylists never seem to have got a grip on the small car. They always look wrong. They never have the panache or style of the best Hondas or even the cars like the Mini.
And just briefly, are you optimistic that something can come out of the shell which is left of GM?
You can certainly argue that it's a good thing for the world as a whole that the car industry is suffering. That's not to say that one wants people to lose jobs. That's horrible. But will GM learn, or the new GM learn? It just simply has to. Cars will change. There's no question about that.
That was Jonathan Glancy. You're listening to Guardian Daily with me, Douglas Hardy. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, Ed Pilkington reports on the fatal shooting of an abortion doctor outside a clinic in Wichita. Get the full story at guardian.co.uk/world. Joanna Moorhead explores the world of over-the-counter medications and supplements. Go to guardian.co.uk/health for more on that. And our economics editor Ashley Seeger digests the latest figures on the state of UK PLC, which seem to show a glimmer of hope. Details at guardian.co.uk/business.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Coming up, are the producers of Britain's Got Talent responsible for Susan Boyle ending up in the Priory? But first, as the latest trial of Aung San Suu Kyi draws to its inevitable close, Burma's most famous political prisoner doesn't lack high-profile support. Gordon Brown has joined showbiz and sporting celebrities in an online campaign to mark her 64th birthday on June the 19th. Barack Obama, Jimmy Carter and Desmond Tutu are also putting pressure on the Burmese authorities. On past form, though, none of this is likely to lead to swift or significant progress. For more on this, here's our reporter, Simon Tisdall.
Well, the problem about Burma has been is that whatever you do, it doesn't seem to make any difference. That's been the case for as long as I can remember, at least two decades, going back to the period before the 1990 election, which, of course, Suu Kyi and the National League for Democracy won, in which the generals then refused to relinquish power. And everything that's been tried since then doesn't seem to have worked. So maybe an online petition is effectively what it is, or a birthday present for Suu Kyi, who's 64 on June the 19th, is worth trying. Although some campaigners say that actually a lot more could be done, but the powers that be in Europe and Asia haven't really tried very hard.
And why do you think that is? I mean, why is sort of Burma a bit like Zimbabwe and one of these regimes which nothing, they seem to be impervious to everything?
Well, Burma is quite a wealthy country despite the massive economic and social mismanagement that goes on there. It has enormous natural resources, including gemstones and timber. And China is very interested in Burma as a supplier of raw materials, and it also interested in selling it arms, likewise Russia. The same goes for India. They both have business there. They both border it. And they're the two with the most leverage. So although Western countries get quite upset about what goes on, they don't really have the economic leverage that China and India have. However, that's not to say they couldn't do more.
What more do you think they could do?
Well, Campaigners like the Burma Campaign UK I've been talking to today say that we haven't really been serious about sanctions with Burma. There isn't really a proper curb on Burmese exports, particularly of rare timber like teak into the EU. There's no monitoring of curbs that do exist, so they're often circumvented. There's not a full ban on investment. There's only a ban on investment in state-owned enterprises. So, for instance, it's quite possible to invest in the Burmese oil sector, which, of course, a lot of European businesses are interested in doing. There's no ban on insurance for companies working there. So, in fact, you can go to the London market and get yourself insured to do business in Burma. And they also, we don't seem to take any notice of very clear breaches of international law in Burma. They are in contravention of the Geneva Conventions. They've regular use of torture and forced labour and so on, which breaches various provisions of the International Labour Organization's code. And they're also in defiance of the UN Security Council. So there are all sorts of grounds for taking legal as well as tougher economic action against them. And it doesn't happen. You tell me why that is.
And coming back to Aung San Suu Kyi specifically, the outcome of the trial, which is going on at the moment, is pretty much a foregone conclusion, isn't it?
Well, one would have thought so. I mean, she was only allowed to bring one witness in her defence, whereas the prosecution put nearly 10 people up to testify against her. The charges seem, on the face of it, very flimsy. It's quite clear that she was a victim of circumstances that were beyond her control in terms of this rather strange American swimming across to her compound. One has to agree with the British ambassador to Rangoon, who suggested that this was all an attempt to keep her out of circulation ahead of next year's elections, which are anyway going to be fiddled by the junta. I wouldn't say it's a lost cause, but this is an extremely unpleasant military regime, which has shown itself during Cyclone Nargis last year to be quite impervious to humanitarian concerns and quite prepared to sacrifice its own people to maintain its own power.
Simon Tisdall there on the latest from Burma. Now, aside from expense account politicians, no one has been under as much media scrutiny recently than Susan Boyle. The runner-up on Britain's Got Talent is now being treated in the Priory. The show's producers say she's emotionally drained and exhausted. But Guardian columnist Roz Coward says that Susan has been ridiculed and exploited in the name of entertainment.
I dreamed a dream in time of life. I dream that love will never die.
I think the producers have been irresponsible with Susan Boyle, but only insofar as all the producers of all these reality stroke talent shows are irresponsible, in the sense that they pretend that the agenda is about one thing when it's really about another, which is the sort of high drama, the kind of discovery of the talent beneath the inauspicious exterior. What I argue is that they do know the kind of consequences of involving ordinary people in this kind of drama.
Do you think basically these kind of shows are cruel? I mean, isn't that what you're saying?
Yes, I do. I think they are the kind of modern-day version of bear baiting, almost. Some of the kind of contestants and people who participate come out on top, and some don't. You know, some are kind of fed to the lions and some aren't. You know, it's almost like the emperor decides which one is going to go and which one is going to live. What I think particularly around Susan Boyle is that they knew exactly what they had on their hands. This sort of very sheltered woman, very plain, very simple, church-going. She had a, as she kept telling us, she had a dream. She wanted to sing. She got a fantastic voice. But they must have thought they had absolutely struck gold, because here was this person who, in kind of so-called real life, would be potentially an object of pity or maybe even fun. And so they put her up in order to kind of slightly play with those feelings. They slightly pretend that, oh, it's taken us all by surprise. It's gone global. It's massive. Everyone's commenting on it. But they know perfectly well that the media is like a kind of a parasite fish sort of travelling along with this media whale, you know.
That's a very good point to end on. I like that. A parasitic fish on a media whale.
Roz Coward there. That's it for today. I'm Douglas Hardy, the producer, Ian Chambers. Thank you for listening. Goodbye for now.